I was really surprised recently when guitarist Sharon Isbin told me that she was a procrastinator. I couldn't believe that. Well, what she was talking about were her back taxes, and now she's all caught up thanks to the time she's had alone to get organized during the pandemic. But she's certainly not a procrastinator when it comes to her music. She has released 3 albums in 9 months, and one of her newest is called Affinity. That's the topic for this edition of New Classical Tracks from American Public Media. I'm Julia Marker. Let's dive in and talk about these 2 new releases because they are also world premiere recordings.
Yes. One is called Strings for Peace, and it's a collaboration that I'm doing of Indian ragas. And then Affinity, which features works from 4 different continents by composers who have written for me. The album includes music by Cuban composer Leo Brower, American composer with Persian background Richard Danielpour, and as well Antonio Lauro in a special arrangement for 2 guitars, and music by Tan Dunn. And the centerpiece is a work that is a world premiere concerto by Chris Brubeck that I premiered in 2015 with the Maryland Symphony, who joins me with their magnificent conductor Elizabeth Schulz on this album. And the actual title of that concerto is called Affinity, which inspired the name of the album.
How did the commission for Affinity with Chris Brubeck come about?
That's fascinating because I was doing a series of concerts on the West Coast with orchestra, and at a luncheon with various donors, one of them approached me and said, "I really love the guitar. I used to play the guitar. I'd like to commission a concerto for you." That doesn't normally happen, right? So I said, "Well, that's a wonderful idea." I had to think of who might be the ideal person since I have worked with so many different people. And I couldn't really approach the same ones again, like John Coriano or Tan Dunn, certainly not Chris Rouse at this point, and Aaron Kurnis. There have just been a real collection of people, but there was one that I had always had in the back of my mind, and that was Chris Brubeck. We had once talked about a collaboration together, but I had never found the funding at that time. So the idea kind of disappeared into the ether, but now here we are. And what was amazing is that we were able to put this together with the funding and a perfect collaborative team. Part of that team was the Maryland Symphony, who joins me on this album. We did the world premiere in 2015 because Elizabeth had already done a lot of Chris's music and some world premieres. So it seemed like the perfect approach to make this come to fruition.
And that's the conductor?
Elizabeth Schulz is the conductor of the Maryland Symphony, celebrating her 20th anniversary season. In fact, we were supposed to perform together in April, but that became part of the collage of pandemic cancellations. It'll be postponed to the following season.
The title Affinity has a very special significance. Would you like to talk about that, please?
Well, one of the things that Chris and I discussed was our mutual love of different styles and genres of music. And as he pointed out, I've worked in collaborations, not only in classical, but with people who come from the world of jazz, rock, folk, bluegrass, Indian, and Brazilian. And he wanted to make something that would really play on that spirit of welcoming and include really a variety of these styles that would fit together in a cohesive way. And he was drawn to the title Affinity because He knew of my interest in science, being a former model rocket builder and launcher. And the definition of affinity, which he sent me, was an attraction or force between particles that causes them to combine. So that really sums up not only my scientific interest, but also the idea of bringing all these worlds together. And it also became the perfect title for the album, since that combines music from China, from Africa, from Cuba, from Persia, from the Americas, and really finding a way to create something new and special.
There's also a tribute to the late Dave Brubeck, Chris's dad. Tell me how he managed to incorporate that and where we hear it within the piece.
That too is a rather fascinating story. When Chris was writing this concerto for me, he did something no composer has ever done in my history of working with so many dozens of different remarkably talented composers. And that was, he said, "Can I drop by? I've got some sketches I'd like you to hear and just get your response." So he did that. And he said, "Do you have any critiques?" And I said, "You really want me to say something that might critique your music as you're writing it?" And he said, "Yes." I said, "Okay, I'll be happy to participate in that." So I gave him little pointers here and there about things that I thought he might be able to change. And when it came to the point where he had written the center slow section, this is a one movement concerto that lasts about 16 minutes. And there's a section in the middle that he played for me, and it was in a very much in a jazz style, but somehow it just didn't speak to me. And I said to him, I said, "You know, you've lost your father, Dave Brubeck, in this last year, and your mother, and I know how close you were to both of them. Is there anything you might want to consider in this piece in terms of a tribute to them?" I didn't tell him about my feeling about the slow movement. I just said this in a way that he might appreciate. And he said, "I am so glad you mentioned that. I really was feeling that, but I was afraid that you only wanted my own music." I said, "No, I want you to write what's in your heart. And if that means drawing on some music of your father and incorporating that in some way, I would be thrilled." So no sooner had we had that discussion, but he sent me some samples to listen to of songs that his father had written. And there was one both the conductor Elizabeth Scholes and I gravitated to immediately, and that was the one called Autumn. Said, "This is it. Bingo, we've got it." And he said that he actually was thinking about that piece because as he was composing, he was looking out the window and seeing the leaves fall. It was autumn. And remembering that particular song that he used to perform with his father. So it really became the core of the piece. Feel really so fortunate that I was able to listen to my instinct about that and share it with him and that he was receptive.
And what do you love most about this piece now that you've had a chance to kind of get it under your fingers, so to speak?
Well, it's great also to have had the opportunity to perform it with a number of different orchestras on it before going into the studio and recording it. And having had time to explore the piece, internalize it, explore the different tempos, the feeling, the expression, the rubato, all of these kinds of things was so important before taking it into its version that you will hear. And in that process, I was able to really get a handle on the swing feeling of the jazz. It opens, he wanted to do something that would open right out of the box. Fun for him to say, but for me, it meant putting in just dozens and dozens of hours on just the first page alone, because in some ways it's the hardest part of the piece. I'm leaping all over the instrument. There's no time to warm up. You just have to enter it and do it full tilt. Then to discover the different kinds of nuances, the jazz kinds of slurs and swings. done this whole Middle Eastern section. Then I had to really basically write the cadenza. Because the cadenza he had written would have been great on a keyboard, but didn't work on the guitar. So we had to put our heads together, and I would show him all kinds of different options. And he said, yes, that one, that one. And we just kind of put it all together. It was funny because, you know, I thought Chris plays electric guitar. He's going to know how to write for my instrument. And what I discovered was that I had to spend really an enormous amount of time editing it. And it might seem simple to take one note out here or there, but it's really not, because I'd have to learn everything at tempo, spend literally dozens of hours doing that, and then deciding which note could go and make it easier to play and really idiomatic for the instrument. And I said, Chris, you know, I was a little surprised by that process, since you do play electric guitar. And he said, oh, that's okay. I figured you would fix it.
Well, there is something to be said for that, right? And that probably made the collaboration that much stronger, because then you started to discover that he wanted you to give that kind of input and feedback.
Yes, I'm so appreciative to him for his openness and his strength. I mean, that just takes an enormous self-confidence and core for a composer to open themselves up in that kind of a vulnerable way to a performer, to say, be part of my process. And I loved it. I really, really did. And in fact, I discovered at one point that I was playing throughout the whole thing, and I thought, you know, the orchestra needs to have a chance to do something too. So there was a whole part towards the end where I said, there's no point in my playing here because you won't hear me anyway. Let the orchestra wail away and have fun with this. It worked out really perfectly.
There's a pretty incredible story behind the Leo Brower piece. He's a composer that you met many years ago after winning a competition when you were a teenager. And then just out of the blue, this handwritten score showed up in your mail. And now you've had the opportunity to record one of his pieces and work on a piece with him. Tell me a little bit about this suite.
It's called El Decameron Negro, which means the Black Decameron. And it is inspired by love stories collected in Africa by a 19th century German anthropologist. Leo had read this book and thought of me and our meeting back at a guitar festival. He knew at that time that I had, in the interval of meeting him at the festival and when he chose to write this piece, that I had been doing a lot of his music because I had heard him play, heard his music, and wanted to find everything I could of his. So I would send him recordings, not with the idea of him writing anything for me, but just to share with him my enthusiasm. I never asked him to compose a work for me. And suddenly this gift appeared in the mail, and I was thrilled. It's in three parts, the three ballads. The first one is called The Harp of the Warrior, or in Spanish, El Arpa del Guerrero. And it's about a warrior who is much beloved by his tribe, and he has saved them on many occasions. So this particular ballad features the energetic, virile energy of the warrior in the fast sections. Contrasting with the slower lyrical ones that express his love of the harp. And actually, that's what got him into trouble, the warrior, because when the tribe discovered that that was something that he loved to do, play the harp, they said, you're out of here, you're banished. That could be a metaphor for many things, and particularly timely in our days today, when there is so much antipathy to people who have other ways of thinking or being. The next ballad is called La Guida de los Amantes por el Valle de los Ecos, the fleeing of the lovers through the Valley of the Echoes. It begins with a momentary forecast of doom, followed by the lover's first gallop. You hear an increasing tempo that is evocative of horses. And then there is a nostalgic remembrance section for a moment. Then this incredible effect that he creates with very fast triplets that alternate between loud and soft to create not only the horses, but going through the valley and that echo effect. The last ballad is called Balada de la Doncella Enamorada, the Ballad of the Maiden in Love. He said, I envision a beautiful young woman walking and her hips swaying and then you have these contrasting sections of very fast, energetic motion. All of this combined together, and that was his gift to me.
I want to just take you back to that moment when you found this handwritten score in the mail and you opened it up. What did that feel like to receive that kind of a gift?
It was astonishing. And I think that because he was not yet as famous as he is now. He's now considered one of the great guitar composers of our time, and this became one of the iconic pieces in his literature that he had written for the instrument. I felt just very honored, and I couldn't wait to start learning this music and discovering it.
Antonio Lauro's Venezuelan Waltz No. 3 is dedicated to his daughter. And you have met his daughter. Tell me more about that meeting.
I was in Caracas, Venezuela at one point, and I happened to be at a party, and everybody was sort of passing a guitar around at this party in a large circle. I can still visualize it. And Antonio Lauro's daughter, Natalia, after whom this waltz is named, was there. Her father had already passed on. So I began to play the waltz dedicated to her, Natalia, and she picked up a Venezuelan folk instrument and started to strum along in accompaniment in the style of the folk guitar of Venezuela. And I've never forgotten the thrill of that. I began to do duo concerts with a former student of mine, Colin Davin, who graduated from Juilliard, got his master's with me there, and had studied with me from the age of 15 at the Aspen Music Festival. He's now on the faculty of the Cleveland Institute of Music, a really brilliant and wonderful creative player. And in our duo concerts together, I asked him at one point, what would you think about doing an arrangement for two guitars of Natalia? Because he is really so talented on that level as well. So he did, and I just loved it and asked him to join me on this album.
Seven Desires for Guitar by Tan Dunn was written for you in 2002. And I know that balance and counterpoint are the most important elements in his writing. How are we hearing that in this piece?
Tan Dun likes to express not only the instrument's history of what he's writing for, in this case, the Spanish guitar background, which goes back to flamenco. Right off the beginning, you hear some stomping of the foot and some hitting of the instrument. That's the flamenco gesture coming out. But also to express something of a related instrument from his world, China. So that would be the pipa. The pipa is an instrument that is played with plectrums on the fingers instead of fingernails. We use our own natural fingernails. They're using metal plectrums. They go in one direction, we strike in the opposite direction. And yet there are so many similarities of technique that are possible. For example, they can do bent notes that have this ghostly evocation. When we do them, it's kind of a la Jimi Hendrix. And they can do this fast tremolando effect where the note is sustained over a long period of time because they're repeating it over and over again. And they do that with all of their fingers. We do a tremolo normally using three fingers and then the thumb and accompaniment. So there had to be a way I could adapt that to create a pipa-like effect. They also do wild strumming, and so do we. There's tapping, there's all kinds of things. So Tan Dun created this remarkable fusion between Chinese folk music and Spanish guitar, and then all these related techniques that fuse together. Tan Dun is inspired as well by ritual. So whether it's the ritual of a funeral and people wailing, or the ritual of a march, or a wedding. That is something that you can hear in this music as well. You have to think about Tan Dun's own background. He was somebody who suffered very much during the Cultural Revolution in China and was one of the people forced to leave the center city and go off into the countryside with the prohibition of not being allowed to play any Western music or instruments. So there he was becoming a rice farmer. And he researched various folk aspects of Chinese music, which come always into his writing, and would use whatever was available, sticks, pans, pots, stones, anything of nature. And this also informed his composition. Then a freak accident happened. The boat carrying the entire Peking Opera Orchestra capsized, everybody drowned. And the government was forced to recall people like Tan Dun back to the city to play in the orchestra. He was then able to find his way from that point to the United States, and the rest is history.
The final piece on the recording is a cycle of songs Richard Daniel Poor wrote for you of love and longing, and it was written for you and Isabel Leonard. The two of you have also put out a recording together. The texts have their origin in the poetry of the great Persian poet Rumi, and it's a cycle of life. Could you go through each of those songs, please?
Yes, the first one is called Listen. And it is really, as Richard described it to me, expresses the agony of birth.
Listen,
The second song is called This Night of Love. It's very sensuous and descriptive. Like a folk dance. And the third one is called Your Beauty. And that, as Richard explained, explores the ecstasy of death. And there's a belief by Rumi and the early Sufis that if you're looking in the face of your beloved, that you're coming as close as possible to seeing, as he describes, the face of God. And in this way, eroticism and spirituality are combined together with this whole lineage of history from India and the Middle East. So it's a song cycle that is very direct and very beautiful and evocative. And I was thrilled to be able to have this opportunity to commission Richard. It really came through Carnegie Hall. They had already programmed me to perform with Isabel Leonard in 2015 in a concert, and they wanted, as part of that, to commission a new composer to write something for us. So we both discussed the idea, and Richard came to mind, and he was thrilled. Actually, he happened to call me the day before I was going to call him to suggest the idea that he write for me. So I can't explain how that happened, but it did. He knew nothing about the Carnegie Commission or anything. It just was a coincidence of the meeting of minds and spirits in a magical way. And this also was his first guitar piece. So he really wanted me to hold his hand during that process and help him with the editing and just finding ways to make the instrument sound idiomatic, which I was, of course, happy to do.
So how are you doing amid the COVID-19 pandemic? I mean, so much has changed, and I'm wondering what you might have discovered about yourself in this process so far.
I actually love this time alone, and I'm really able to complete some projects that I had procrastinated about before.
What? You just did 3 recordings in 9 months. What could you possibly be procrastinating about?
I probably shouldn't say this, but I had to catch up on a few years of taxes, which I'd had no time to do. And in doing so, I had to find a creative way of delivering the paperwork. So I would jog 5 miles along the Hudson for each of the years to deliver the papers to my accountant. And actually, that turned out to be thrilling because all the trees were in bloom, the cherry trees, the magnolia, the dogwood. It was just exquisite, this run. That was the only good part about the experience. But, you know, you have to find something good in everything, right? I feel liberated. I'm all caught up, and I can actually start to do some fun things.
Sharon Isbin, with an affinity for music from all over the world, and that's also the title of her new recording. If you're enjoying new classical tracks, the absolute best thing that you can do for the show is to tell somebody else about it. Help spread the word, and take a moment to rate and review us on your podcasting app. Thanks to Valerie Kaler for producing this episode of New Classical Tracks from American Public Media. I'm Julia Monker.